I'm going to hand this session over to Stephanie Gottlieb. Stephanie is the Executive Officer of Children with Disability Australia. She commenced in the role in 2008. She has a social work background and has worked in the area of disability for 20 years. This has included working in direct service provision, management and governance. Stephanie has experience of disability as a sibling and as a parent. And one of the great things about Steph is she challenges the system to make improvements for children and families of children with disability. It is my great pleasure to hand this session over to Steph, who will chair the inclusive education session. Stephanie, over to you.
Thank you very much, Robin. Thank you very much, everyone, for attending what will be, I'm sure, a very thought-provoking and informative discussion on inclusive education this morning. I just want to spend 1 minute or 30 seconds speaking briefly about Children with Disability Australia, for those of you who don't know much about us. We're the national peak body for children and young people with disability. We have about 5,000 members nationally. We're a fairly young organisation in many ways, being independent and launched in 2010. Our work is informed and driven by the direct experiences of children and young people with disability. So we cover that 0 to 25 cohort, so across all levels of education. Throughout our short history, it's fair to say that CDA has been inundated by members' concerns regarding equal access and opportunities to education. Education is one of the most significant areas of concern raised by our constituents, and it's a central focus of the work that we undertake. It's frequently reported to CDA that children and young people with disability report that through their educational experiences, they are subjected to limited opportunities, low expectations, exclusion, inadequate resourcing, inadequately trained staff, bullying, discrimination, and we're seeing increasing incidents being reported to us of restraint and seclusion, which I think is very much a product of a system that is struggling to meet the needs of these children. The relentless nature of these experiences led CDA to commission Macquarie University to develop the issues paper, which today's session is based upon. So that's the inclusion in education towards equality for students with disability. I don't have a copy here to show you, sorry, but it is available on our website for those wanting to download it. So that's www.cda.org.au. And we launched it in October, I think, last year. And since that time, we've had a phenomenal uptake of this paper, with there being over 10,000 downloads as at the end of June. I lost my spot. CDA was keen to know what research and available evidence said about inclusive education. And the more positive experiences that were reported to us and that we learnt of education involved a really common theme of inclusion. So we thought we really need to get a paper around what's happening and what's available and what we know about it and pull these themes together. Well, what is inclusive education? I'm sure we'll discuss that today. In the issues paper, let's start by saying I think it's one of the most contested terms in education, but certainly in terms of the issues paper, which we're using as a base of our discussions today, Kathy Colligan, the author, gives this definition. And it's quite long, but I'm going to read it to you. Inclusive education involves embracing human diversity and welcoming all children and adults as equal members of an educational community. This involves valuing and supporting the full participation of all people together within mainstream education settings. Inclusive education requires recognising and upholding the rights of all children and adults and understanding human diversity as a rich resource and an everyday part of all human environments and interactions. Inclusive education is an approach to education free from discriminatory beliefs, attitudes and practices, including free from ableism. Inclusive education requires putting inclusive values into action to ensure all children and adults belong, participate and flourish. What the paper clearly demonstrates is that inclusive education is best practice in relation to education of students with disability. Inclusive education, however, is not a reality for too many students with disability in Australia. In this session, we're going to hear from our panel of speakers about their thoughts and experiences of education and inclusion, and there will be an opportunity for questions and discussions following their presentations. So I'm going to introduce our panel. First of all, we have the lovely Madeline Sobb. Madeline is a project officer at the Youth Disability Advocacy Service. She works with young people with disability on systemic advocacy projects. Madeline is in her final years of health science degree in disability studies. On the end, we have Nicholas Pohl. Nick is the Deputy Secretary in the Regional Services Group of the Victorian Department of Education and Early Childhood Development. The Regional Service Group supports regional partnerships, regional early childhood services, schools and other education providers to deliver services. Finally, last but not least, Elizabeth McGarry. Elizabeth is the Chief Executive Officer of the Association for Children with Disability in Victoria. ACD Vic assists children with a disability and their families through the provision of information, support and advocacy. Elizabeth has personal experience of disability in her family and strongly believes that real life experiences must inform the development and implementation of public policy. And boy, have we had a few discussions about that over the years. All good. So let's start, and we'll start with Madeline.
Can everyone hear me?
Yes.
Cool. Okay, so hi everyone, my name is Madeline, I'm 24 and as Stephanie just said, I'm the project officer at the Disability Advocacy Service and I'm also a university student. I grew up in Newcastle in New South Wales and moved to Melbourne in 2011 to go to university. I attended mainstream Catholic schools throughout my primary, secondary and senior schooling. My primary school experience would probably mostly be positive. I was the first student with disability to attend my primary school, and because of that reason, I feel as though the school did a pretty good job at providing me with the same school experience as my peers, due to the fact that they hadn't had that experience before or needed to support another student with a disability. However, when I was 7 years old, I had some major spinal fusion surgery, which meant I was in hospital for a long time and was in hospital in Sydney, I'm not in Newcastle, so I was away from my family a lot, and it also meant that I was had a lot of time off school. And once I came home from hospital, I spent a further 18 months needing to lay flat on my back, which meant I only attended school 2 to 3 days a week, being pushed around on a portable bed at school. And the school did the best they could to support me during this time, but I still managed to fall behind academically because of how much time I had off school. And as always, my parents did what they thought was best at the time, but I, looking back now, wish that the school had maybe discussed with my parents about me repeating a year, because I didn't realise how much I had fallen behind until I got to high school. So my secondary schooling was a school that was year 7 to 10, and the school that my parents wanted to send me to was a wheelchair user's worst nightmare, and was across 6 levels and was not accessible at all. And so there was a lot of discussion before I went there as to whether I was going to be able to go there in the first place and be with my friends, because that's what the school that all my friends were going to. I was very excited when the school was able to install an elevator and then fix a few other little access issues, and I thought that everything was going to be smooth sailing from there on. Yeah, I was quite wrong about that. The elevator continually broke down with me inside it, and my classroom teachers continually didn't provide me with the support I needed, such as copies of notes from the blackboard, and sometimes a little extra time to get homework and assignments done. I was always a last thought when it came to school excursions, which generally meant that my parents had to drive me to and from an excursion instead of me travelling on a bus with my peers. Two of the biggest issues for me at secondary schooling included when I was in year eight, and I had a physical education teacher who failed me in the subject because I couldn't participate in the practical classes. Instead, I was given activities to do with another student in my class who had an eating disorder and was not allowed to participate in case she lost more weight. It was suggested to this teacher that she come and assess me based on my horse riding program that I was doing on a weekly basis instead of Friday afternoon sport. She didn't like this very much. The second issue I had was when I decided to take on a textiles and design subject as an elective for year 9 and 10. I was never allocated much time with an integration aid previous to this. However, by this time, I was allocated 4 hours per week to assist me in the practical classes for this subject. As you get older, the workload becomes bigger, and I was not supported well enough in my classes. My parents and I continually approached the school about needing more time in classes with an aide, but was continually told that there was no money. My senior high school experience, which was year 11 and 12, was probably my most positive schooling experience. The school took the lead with organising my transition arrangements and sometimes even thinking ahead about issues that might arise even before I had thought of them. The school already had an elevator, but again, it continually broke down, but this time the school moved as many of my classes to the ground floor as possible. I generally had very accommodating classroom teachers who did their best to support me. One significant thing I remember being an issue was when all Year 12 students were to go on a compulsory school retreat. I had told the school months before that they would need to provide a bus with wheelchair access and a hoist to enable me to stay in my wheelchair for the trip. I gave them the contact details of the bus company who had the right buses, but I'm still waiting for the right bus. They forgot to order the bus, and my wheelchair had to be stored underneath the bus, not tied down, and my support worker had to carry me up the stairs. Not very dignified for a 17-year-old. The toughest part of my senior schooling was fitting in socially. I had 500 students in my year, and I didn't feel like I fitted in with my friends because I didn't have an after-school job, or I wasn't thinking about which boy I was going to kiss at the party on the weekend. It was really difficult because I felt like it was a time in my life where my social life should have been taking off, but instead I feel like I didn't have the same opportunities to a social life like my friends did. In conclusion, I feel as though we make inclusive education seem as though it is one big scary thing that if we can't provide all of what a person needs at once, then we don't try at all. We put it into the too hard basket. No student's education experience is perfect, and mine certainly wasn't, but I feel as though if we continue to look at students individually, there will always be changes that can be made to enhance their experience. Inclusion just starts with some thought about it in the first place. Thank you.
Thanks, Madeline. That was great.
Thanks.
Nicholas.
Can I begin by acknowledging the traditional owners in the land in which we meet today and pay my respect to elders past and present? And Madeline, thank you for that wonderful story of your experience. And sitting here or standing here representing that education system, so to speak, I mean, how do I defend that? You can't. I think what is crucial is that actually we are here standing here today and involved in conferences such as this, listening to the voices of people who have those experiences and looking at what we can do to address those. So if I can maybe go to the slides. Oh. Right, my slides and notes for those of you who are on the screen above. The first thing is, in terms of the department's thinking at the moment, and I'll share these slides online subsequently, but firstly, we're absolutely committed to ensuring and improving opportunities for all learners within the system without exception. It's our fundamental belief that actually learners are engaged and progressing and achieving within their schools, within early childhood settings, and with post-school environments. And absolutely critical to that is that students are welcomed into their school of choice and fully included. And I think your report that you referred to outlines very clearly what that looks like. From my perspective, there are probably seven kind of key platforms that when I'm thinking about how well a school's performing, and I'm going to focus just on schools here because we also work in maternal child health services, early intervention services and post-school, but I just want to focus as I go forward in terms of school environment. If we're reviewing a school, if I'm trying to influence a school, if I'm looking at the dimensions within a school that need to be successful in terms of inclusion, they are as follows. Strong governance. And I think in Victoria we too often don't look at, you know, what is the role of a school council in setting the expectations that exist within a school? Secondly, that there is a clear vision and strategy in the school. And that this includes elements of inclusion, supporting diversity, that there's effective management and leadership, that there's a positive and inclusive culture, values and climate operating in the school, that we have effective teaching practices and teachers know what is required in terms of adapting their curriculum and classroom practices, that we have a foundation of productive partnerships, and that schools use the resources that they have effectively to support learning from all, for all learners. So going through a couple of these in detail. Firstly, school councils need to represent their communities in terms of governance. They need to be active in listening to the needs of all in their community and representing all voices, ensuring in particular that they resolve issues that may come before the school. In terms of the work we're doing as a department, we're looking at addressing three areas in terms of governance. There is a review of governance presently underway. We're looking at a new performance and accountability system, which is presently being rolled out across Victorian state schools, including strong elements in terms of how schools are supporting inclusion and diversity. And we're reviewing, and I'll touch at the end, what we're doing around complaints management and issue management. In terms of strategy and the vision that the school has for itself, ensuring that values of inclusion and diversity are actually the absolute starting points in terms of the school's approach to inclusion, that their strategy underpins what the school is doing, that they're active in looking at the data, and how well they're doing for each and every learner within the school, and that there is an explicit agenda between what the school's doing and the learning of each and every student. In terms of our focus at present, clearly having schools articulate and describe what they're trying to achieve through strategic planning and annual implementation plans, and looking to ensure that within those documents, inclusion, supporting diversity and students with disabilities is absolutely explicit, and there are critical goals in there. The next, in terms of effective leadership and management, and a lot of research in education says that the biggest impact on learning outcomes outside of the home and external environment is the classroom teacher. I would actually say it's the leadership in the school. It's the principals and senior management in the school that set the values, ethos, what's important in a school, what's not important. And so in starting this, in my discussion and going into a school, what do I look for? Clearly that there are high expectations for student learning and for every student's learning, and that every staff member is committed to successful outcomes for every student. There are clear roles and structures and accountabilities in the school, including accountabilities for student welfare and for supporting students with additional needs. So Madeline doesn't have to wait for the bus that never comes. Thirdly, there's clear goals, monitoring system, and teachers are being held to account for that. And we, again, are doing a lot, placing a lot of focus and emphasis in transforming these areas. I mean, I can't deny I don't come across schools that aren't welcoming environments. They need to be, and we need to hold them to account. They need to provide safe physical and emotional learning environments. They should actually have two lifts, Madeline, not one.
Yeah.
They need to be caring cultures. But I've too often worked with schools where you go into the school and people say, in terms of supporting students with additional needs, they're doing God's work. Aren't they special? Aren't they working beyond? No, they get a salary to do that. That is their core job. And actually, I don't want just a caring environment. I want an environment that's going to challenge and educate those kids who are in that classroom. We also need an environment that actively looks at integrating allied health and welfare services within school environments. Effective teaching practice, and much has been said about this. Yes, we do need to look at initial teacher training. We do need to look at an ongoing drive to lift the capability and capacity of every teacher in the state. Their capacity to work with a broad mix of students with challenging needs, with different needs. They need to, however, start from a basis of practice that is evidenced, and there is a research foundation to it. And then on top of that, that they monitor and adjust what they are doing in line with the impact it's having, and in particular, what's not working, and adjust that practice. Productive partnerships and working in disability education, I think, requires a much stronger intent in terms of working on in a productive way with multiple players and multiple supports. Firstly and paramount is the criticality of the relationship with parents and making sure it's right for parents as well as the learner, and looking at including other service providers in there and how you can operate as an integrated team. So we're doing a lot of work at present around a concept of team around the learner. Equally, in terms of the Barwon launch site for NDIS, thinking a lot about how we might develop models where we are much more integrated with those external providers to the school. And lastly, in terms of my platform, resource using the resources that you have as a school effectively and managing those, ensuring that they are aligned with the learning journey. And quite often schools say, well, I'm not resourced enough for dealing with this particular child with this particular need. Am I allowed to say it in here? That's crap. Actually, the school's got to look at its full resource, including its professional staff, its relationships, its networks, its goodwill. I've seen some very small schools in very isolated areas working with young people and doing stunning things with very few resources, and I can talk more about those. And lastly, and I put this in for just to acknowledge that actually sometimes it does go wrong. And schools need to be active in managing that, and our system needs to be active in managing that. And all too often I see a great diversity in our approach to dealing with issues, a lack of recognising and acknowledging issues, and issues and problems that crop up that take too long to resolve and escalate beyond the school gate. And I would say that the best and most effective way of resolving issues when they go wrong is in the school, with the professionals and staff in the school. So in that regard, we have a program of work at the moment looking at our complaints and issues management program, strengthening the role of our disability coordinators, looking at how we can better support training and complaints management. And for this conference, actively looking at the role of advocates in the system. And I strongly believe in the role of advocacy on behalf of people who have issues with the system. It's an important factor, and we need to, within our school system, look at how we formalise that role in terms of working towards resolution. And lastly, how can we strengthen some of our central processes to ensure there is independent scrutiny and stronger feedback loops into policy and practice into resolving issues? Thank you.
Thank you, Nicholas. I'm sure there'll be some lots of questions around that. I know that I've got a few, but I'll keep it till later. Last up, but not least, I'd like to welcome Elizabeth McGarry to speak.
Thanks, Stephanie. I don't want all my peas to pop, so I won't get too close. Thanks very much. It's great to have the opportunity to sit on this panel with my fellow panellists and with Steph. As the Association for Children with a Disability has been operating in Victoria for over 30 years, and a key area of our work, just as it is for CDA at the national level, is supporting students with a disability. So we have a free telephone service to support children and their families to try and achieve the best outcomes they can in education and in so many other elements of their lives. Consistently over the years that I've been heading up ACD, which is just over six now, we have supported anywhere between 600 and 800 families, students, families, each year in an advocacy role to try and support them to achieve good outcomes with whatever the hitch is that they've encountered. So I'm going to talk to you about three areas where generally those 600 to 800 issues fall. But before I do that, I'd like to acknowledge the fact that people come to us when they've got a problem. And so it's important to recognise that, yes, these issues exist, but there's also lots of good teachers out there, lots of good principals doing a good job, but we don't hear about that as well. So it's important to create a context around what I'm going to say and to create some balance. And clearly the department's policies, almost to an, to each one, is good. The rubber hits the road when in practice it doesn't actually happen on the ground. And it's not... It doesn't just sit with the department around trying to fix that. There are issues outside of the department as well, which I'll talk about. So the three categories really where issues sit are around communication and the breakdown of communication, exclusion and how that occurs, and also when challenges become quite significant, there can be a tendency to focus on the child that's got the issue. So I'll just go back to communication. So as I said, you know, policies to all intents and purposes are good. It's when they're not implemented that the problem arises. So to a certain extent that's around skill level with teachers and issues around sitting with students and families to develop an individual learning plan or to be participating in student support group meetings. That often there will be conversations between the people around the table, and individual learning plans will be developed and strategies and ideas that could be explored or have been demonstrated to work in the past have been identified. But then what often happens is that they're not implemented down the track. And equally, student support group meetings where there's opportunities to readjust and review what's been happening and put new ideas in place, or to go back to some of those original strategies, that often that doesn't happen. And we get to the point where a key area of student support group meetings are talking about, you know, what's gone wrong, and it's an incident-driven meeting rather than a planning implementation meeting. And also it's around valuing what students and families say works, and the educators recognising and honouring the experience that students and families bring to the table. So often then those issues with communication and some tension that then begins to build means that having a resolution or a solution focus to the conversations doesn't occur, and so communication starts to break down, and that's often when we get the phone calls. Exclusion tends to happen just a similar to what Madeline was saying before around not planning and thinking through how a student can be included in whatever the activity might be. So not teachers and educators not having the skills to adapt what they might be doing or what they're planning to do. So parents will be told, we're going on an excursion, but you know your child can't come for whatever reason, and that's particularly an issue for camps. So we often get a spike in October around lots of parents ringing up and saying, my child isn't going on camp at the end of the year. We've just been told, you know, what can you do about it, and can you help us come up with a better solution to that? So those sorts of issues around exclusion, and sometimes it can be even less obvious than that as well. And when communication breaks down and we're sort of getting down to the pointy end of trying to resolve issues and they're escalating, that often it then becomes the focus of, well, this child's got this problem, and it almost becomes the onus is on the child to fix things, to adjust their behaviour, to do something different to make the situation go away. And there can be quite a focus on the symptom rather than reflecting on what the cause is and working out how to resolve the cause. And so that level of self-reflection for educators to ask themselves and think about, well, what can I do to change this situation? to become a circuit breaker or whatever, that doesn't happen often. And so the individual advocacy meetings that we become involved in, it's often about trying to change that conversation away from, you know, the kid's doing this or the kid's doing that, to looking at, okay, well, what can be done to try and, circuit break this situation. So clearly they're, I would say, the three general areas that we do most of our work. So I'm just going to give you some quick stats here. At the moment we're looking at finalising our state election campaign, and so working on our platform around education. And a key area of it is better pre-service training, so that graduate teachers coming into the classroom are better skilled. So some of our investigations at this stage, we've been looking at the actual curricula that's provided in Victorian universities around undergraduate education degrees. There are 49 undergraduate education degrees currently being provided in Victoria. Only 6 of the 9 offer units that focus on individual or disability support in education. Out of the 49 courses, there are only 10 units that focus on either individual learning or specifically disability education. Nearly all of those 10 units out of the 49 are electives. And education students are not required to complete them in order to graduate. If study of individual or disability support is desired by tertiary students, further study is required, so postgraduate or additional certificates. So as you can see, a student teacher can actually go through their whole professional training, come out into the school system and not be upskilled. So clearly that's a massive issue, because they just aren't equipped, and I think that they're really being set up to fail in those circumstances. So at ACD we can't create all the changes that need to take place in education. So we're working on key areas that we think are really important, and this one in particular is absolutely key. So I might leave it at that and we can have some discussion, further discussion.
Thank you very much, Elizabeth. That was very interesting. Sure. Yes, you can. Got secrets in there.
No.
Sorry, I thought I got some first-hand knowledge there. I was trying to steal his notepad. Thank you very much, everyone. That was very interesting. I'm happy to kick off with a question since I've got the mic. It strikes me in a lot of the work that we do is that I think the reform, there's a greater recognition of reform, but we're still stuck in integration, whereas we're trying to get the kids to fit the system. And I'm just wondering what everyone's experiences of that is and what you think we need to do to progress, to make that change from integration to inclusion.
I'm happy to start. I think the comment that Nick made earlier about all schools are there to teach all children, and the issue of children with a disability or students with a disability being provided support through the PSD, the Program for Students with a Disability, that's the way students should be supported. And there's all issues around that equaling for lots of people, that equaling an integration aid. So I think that's a challenge, but the challenge even before that is that schools need to see that their global budget is there to support all children, and that it's not children with a disability equals PSD.
I mean, I think the general direction that education is travelling is that
all students need to have their individual learning goals and objectives set and established. It's not just we will do this with a particular group of students. That classroom teachers need to look very, very much more at having the voice of the student in helping determine what their objectives are, what they are trying to achieve, and build that into their classroom practice. And lastly, I think we are in a state of change. We have much more team teaching, much more group work, much more learning from each other. And I think I would like to see students with disabilities, you know, being the one that everyone learns from, not just one way or one direction in terms of our thinking.
I think schools and general classroom teachers should not be surprised when they have a student with a disability in their classroom. And I think that also comes back to the expectation that classroom teachers do need specific training. And I think that sort of seems to be the only way forward. And as well as that, classroom teachers need to be more aware that the student themselves generally know what their needs are and the family that is supporting them as well.
Thanks. We got a mic.
Jared.
Sorry. She's coming with the mic now. She'd just like to introduce yourself and your question.
Just let him know you've got the front. Yeah.
Hi. Is that working?
Yeah. It is.
Hi, Maurice Gleeson. Look, this is giving my age away. I go back to the years when I lost my sight suddenly at the age of nearly 13. So from being sighted in October, by the November I was totally blind. By the February of the next year I was enrolled in a specialist school for the blind. So it was specifically for students with multiple disability, but they had a blind or vision impaired. And it was a boarding school. I'm not sure if today, if it happened to me now, whether I would have coped as well, because in those days, it was a boarding school, our every needs were catered for as far as not the academic side so much, I think that was lacking, but as far as the social development go, the physical education side went, that peer support went, it was just absolutely wonderful, even though it still took me about 10 years to adjust from being sighted to being blind. But the peer support, the interaction, we had every single sporting recreational activity designed, because we made up our own rules and our own brand and everything, and with a very supportive environment. I think the challenge today is, often we have we label people with disability as if somehow we're all falling into one category, that we're all the same. If you're blind or vision impaired, if you have a physical disability, we all are unique. It's a huge ask for the education system or a teacher to become expert or especially in every area of disability. I guess it's going to be a huge challenge. The concern that I have for a lot of students today is what do they do as far as physical education goes, after school activity. And the other thing is, not everybody, unfortunately, has a supportive environment, family, etc. So they're all some of the real big challenges. So you've got to have the capability, the capacity, but more importantly, the commitment. If you don't have those, and this has been covered, I'm just really, really repeating some of what the speakers have said. But there, so I wonder now, without those specialist schools as much, you know, is it better? Is it worse? Is it no different? It'll be, you know, Blind Spot Victoria, we're going to be working with La Trobe University to do some research in this whole area. So hopefully in some time we might have some evidence to see what the changes are.
Thank you. Did someone want to respond to that?
I mean, I can comment
So my background is I had teaching parents. I grew up and lived on site at a school for the blind in another jurisdiction. In that situation, young blind children at three, I think, were taken from their families across the country and put into residential arrangements where they lived till the age of about 22, 23 when they left those centres. I think the arrangements that we have now where vision education sits in every community and is the responsibility of every school doesn't mean that we have to look to an NGO for not-for-profit community group to provide quality education, that actually we should be expecting the sort of experience that you're talking about at the school that you went to being delivered for every student in every setting.
Yeah, and certainly, I mean, it goes to the guts of our paper that when we look at the what the evidence is saying is that best practice is inclusion, and that doesn't mean that people aren't learning well in separate settings or specialist settings, but best practice is inclusion, and how I think with the greater prevalence now of students with disability in every class, I think it would be realistic to say has at least one or two children with disability in their class, that we need to look at, you know, how we provide enriched education for all students.
Hello. My name is Jared Manon, and I'm here on behalf of Oneness today. Victorian, I went to a special school as well, and it wasn't really the best education I got academically, but like the previous question, it was very good physically and helped me get wheelchairs and whatever. My question is, do you guys, all of you guys, think that special schools are still scapegoats for mainstream education systems, where it's like people lock up with their disabled child or someone becomes disabled during school and they just automatically get told, well, you know, there's this wonderful thing called a special school, then you can just go there and all your problems will be solved. Do you think government and schools are spending too much money and time focused on putting people through special schools because the bricks and mortar are already set up to accommodate them physically and sometimes intellectually, but fail academically?
That's a tough question. My response to that would be probably yes, but in my opinion, I am under the understanding that a lot of families tend to send their child to a special school with the idea that all their therapy needs and equipment needs and everything else will be supported, and also because the family might be unaware of the educational experience that their child will receive at a special school. So I think families tend to focus more on what their child's physical needs are at the time.
Yep. I think one of the issues, Jared, is that is around medical science, and I don't think that there's a simple answer to the question that you pose. And I think that mainstream education hasn't kept up with the advancements that medical science have achieved. So therefore, we have children of student age, students, who are using ventilators and have extremely high medical needs that are almost nursing care level. And so I believe that if to create inclusion universally, we actually have to build it first, and then people will come. So if mainstream have, you know, all the educators have the right attitude, the right skills, create the right environment, people will go to mainstream. They will choose mainstream over specialist. And also we have quite a few families who choose specialists because they feel like their children are more likely to be bullied in mainstream. So sometimes it's a protective issue. I'll leave it at that.
And it's around 90%, I think, of students with disability that actually attend mainstream schools. Is that right, Mark? Yeah.
I mean, I will...
Nationally?
I'll just reiterate Elizabeth's comments, but add to that, presently the policy platform is providing choice.
And I just have to say this, that it's actually not an informed choice, I think. and I think, and also being, I mean, Elizabeth would have done the same. When you speak with so many families and you're confronted with that, they may look at different options, and you're very, you know, the local school says very clearly, we would welcome your child, but we just feel unclear about how we're going to meet his or her needs. Sometimes you feel very unwelcome at a school, you know, and because there's a level of ignorance and lack of expertise there. What do? You go to the option where you think your child's needs are best going to be met, whether they're educational, whether they're physical, whether they're academic. So it's, you know, I think what Elizabeth said around we've got to build the framework, then the decisions, then I think we'll see some different decisions. Probably got enough time for one or two more questions. Oh.
This lady's had her
lady's had her hand up for ages with... Yep. Just...
Oh, thank you very much. My name's Kylie Tholborn and I'm from Warrnambool, and I'm first and foremost a mother of a young man who's 13 in mainstream education, who uses a wheelchair for mobility and also has a hearing loss, was born very premature. So from your understanding of prematurity, you know these children are often born without not a lot of hope in their life, and but fortunately once they get over the insidious medical problems that they face, then these children grow and prosper very, very well, at my son being one of those. So I just wanted to acknowledge one point from Nicholas, and it was about the right of education, and I think that's a really important point to acknowledge. But the right of education in one's own community is even more important. Living regional, we don't have choice, we don't have option, and often we're left with the education facilities that are presented with us. How do we change their ideology and culture and make them more accommodating to our children is doing some of the things that you've all very much touched on today, in particular Madeline, and my son's still waiting to get on the bus. It's something that's not going to go away. But what disturbs me is when governments, unfortunately, make it difficult for infrastructure to change. My personal example of this is during the building revolution when my son was at primary school and there was ramps to his educational facility. The building revolution changed and allowed for older temporary units to be upgraded. Unfortunately, in that upgrade, the ramp was not included in the upgrade. Now, what does this say to the community? What does this say as a government? What does this say as an education forum? We want to educate these kids, but you know what? Let's not worry about the access. And that really is the very first point of call is the access. Yes, it's going to cost money, but Warrnambool is another example. Look at our special school. It is overwhelmed with students at the moment, and access to the other educational platforms in the community are reduced because there is no access. My son, being the wheelchair user, chose the site, chose the school with the six different levels, and it's working well. But I think the conversation and the real starting point outside of the learning experience is the infrastructure, the environment, and the culture. The culture won't change unless we look at our buildings. Thank you for your time.
And I think fundamental to that is attitude, you know, in terms of, yeah, an attitude of inclusion and an expectation of inclusion. But did someone else want to respond to that?
I mean, I would say it's a rule, it's an expectation, and I'll talk with you after this because
good enough.
It's not. Yeah.
Yeah, we might just let you have that discussion later with Nicholas. I'm sorry, everyone, we're out of time. I apologise. I just wanted to, in conclusion, I'd like to thank our speakers very much. I think they've done a wonderful job. Thank you, if you'd like to join with me and thank them. And just in conclusion, I'm very mindful, you know, and we all fall into it, but when I also around, I was looking at a lot of the letters in the paper today about the young baby that is top of everyone's mind at the moment. But it was talking around support needs and costs and burdens and whatever. I just want to remind everyone how it's very clear, again in our paper, but through our own experiences, that a school community is greatly enriched through having students with disability as part of it. It's very clear in terms of not only positive outcomes for the students themselves with disability, but their peers, for teachers, in all areas. And I think we need to keep that top of mind when we're looking at what we're doing here around inclusion, that our school communities will be greatly enriched through having the full participation and equal opportunities for students with disability. Thank you, everyone, and I'll hand you over to Robin.